Hello there, friends. Welcome to ExoLore, the show that helps you imagine other worlds with facts and science. I am your host, Dr. Moya McTeer. I'm an astrophysicist who studied pretty much everything in space, from planetary orbits to the radiation left over from the Big Bang to star formation and black holes and galaxy evolution. But I am especially interested in the motion of stars and how that affects the habitability of exoplanets, which are planets outside of our solar system. I am also a folklorist who specializes in building and analyzing fictional worlds, and this podcast is my way of sharing those worlds and that knowledge with you. So let's get started.
Oh, I've had so many recording mishaps. I remember the first time I ever recorded a podcast. This was back like 3 years ago. My partner and I started a podcast, a very short-lived one, and we had to record the first episode three different times. Because the first time I recorded it fine, but I was on GarageBand, which I wasn't used to. So I had to re-record it after accidentally deleting everything. And then the second we just weren't recording. Didn't notice. And then the third time was the charm.
But the third time you were just like, yeah, this is a podcast, whatever. I don't care if you're listening.
Definitely sounded very different by the third time around. Do you have any stories of like bad podcasting mistakes that you've witnessed or done?
Oh, I mean, all of them. I've done all of them. I started, my first podcast I made was with my roommate, 2016, I think.
I thought you were about to say like 20 years ago, and I was like, you're not.
No.
You're not that old.
And we recorded the show, and it was fun. Like, I've never had any tech mishaps because I've been doing tech really for a long time, but every single like content creative mistake you could make, I've done and learned from.
Oh, it's that second part that's important, the learning from it.
Yes.
Yeah. So now that we know that you make a lot of mistakes, I'm sure a lot of people who listen to ExoLore also listen to other multitude shows. That's probably how they found ExoLore. But just in case people don't know who you are, do you want to tell us who you are and what you do in your own words?
Yeah. Hello, I'm Brandon Grugel. I am a sound designer, all around sound person, editor, blah, blah, blah. I've done a little bit of directing as well. At Multitude, I am the head of production, and previously I've worked at places like Marvel and SiriusXM and for freelance clients like the Bright Sessions Universe and other things like that.
You really are a sound person.
I am a sound person.
How did you become a sound person? Were you born with just like amazing hearing? Did you have, like Batman, like a traumatic but important experience with sound as a child?
I wish. I like to think that I have bad vision and color blindness, so my eyes are just bad. No, but I've been a musician since I was like 4 or 5, I think. I started playing drums when I was really young, started taking drum lessons. So I've just gone from there and just played music my whole life. And that sort of just like blossomed into normal curiosity into the things around it. So when I was 16, I did, actually, I think I was 15, which was technically illegal, but I got a job at a water park as a lifeguard and made a couple $1,000s over the summer and bought a bunch of studio equipment and then started recording my own stuff and my friend's stuff and some other folks from high school. And really fell in love with the tech side of it. And then I went to college for music business because I was trying to be practical.
That doesn't work out usually.
Nope. And I kind of regret not going into more of like a hands-on production role. But I learned a lot of really useful stuff that I still use today, like copyright law and things like that. And I realized after doing like 5 internships in the music industry that the music industry is broken and anything but a meritocracy. And like I really wanted to do artist management because I really enjoyed that. And I worked at a company called C3 Artist Management. And they had just opened up their New York wing. They're based in Austin. And I was one of 3 interns, I think, at the time, all unpaid, no credit, very illegal.
Oh, God. It's awful.
Yeah. But there was like the manager proper and then like the assistant manager. That was the whole office at the time. And the assistant manager had worked there for like something like 8 years already. And he wasn't a manager yet. It's just a nightmare. So I decided to be a big fish in a little pond instead. And I fell in love with podcasts and started doing that instead.
Nice. Was there a particular podcast that made you fall in love with it?
Yeah, I had a job right out of college that's basically data entry kind of thing at Nielsen Entertainment or Nielsen. I don't know what they call themselves, but the TV ratings people.
Got it.
And so it was basically data entry and like data validation. So I would just listen to podcasts all day long while I was doing that. And I first one I found was My Brother and Me. I think I just looked on the charts of like top podcasts and it was on there. And I wanted something that wasn't, I had been listening to Stuff You Should Know, which is still one of my favorite podcasts, but that's very educational, you know? So I wanted something that was just like funny and I could sort of zone out while listening to. And I found that. I was like, oh, this is what podcasting can be. It doesn't have to be just like edutainment. And so that's, yeah, from there, I just found a bunch of stuff and dug it.
That's awesome. I live almost exclusively in the educational podcast tab of Spotify. Mm-hmm. I only venture out when someone specifically recommends like a comedy or a fiction podcast to me.
I feel it. I mean, I read mostly nonfiction books. Like I'm in that same realm. Yeah.
Yeah. What was the first time you sound designed a podcast?
Yeah, it was definitely JTP, I would say, Join the Party, okay. Which I forgot to mention somehow in my introduction. The show that we that we made that then sort of like evolved and blossomed with other podcasts into Multitude is called Join the Party. It's a D&D 5e actual play podcast. I and Eric Silver and Amanda sort of came together to make this show. I did the sound design, Amanda did the business, and Eric did the creative, the DMing. So it was a nice equitable split at that time.
Nice.
So yeah, I had listened to, actually, ironically enough, my partner Lauren's podcast before we knew each other at all, The Bright Sessions. And
oh, that's so cute.
Yeah, I was a big fan. I'm a nerd. It's very sickening. listened to that and Wolf 359. Those two shows were the first fiction shows I listened to. And I was, again, another like sort of brain explosion of like, oh, podcasts can do this. That's cool. And so I wanted to do something similar for JTP to make it sort of stand out from the crowd. And so I started sound, I like to call it like rough draft sound designing because it's very much like a version one that goes out as published. Because it's so long that there's just no time to really like dig into it. But I had jobs that I think I was working at Sirius XM at the time, so I was getting off at, you know, like 5:36, like a normal time. So I had plenty of time to work on this show. And yeah, I sort of just took it as a nice, it was biweekly, so I had to do it every 2 weeks. And it was very much like learn by doing. Mm-hmm. So like I just threw everything at the wall that I'd been curious about and saw what worked, saw what didn't. I got to experiment a whole bunch of different, because it's fantasy, so you get to like experiment with a whole bunch of different stuff and figure out what sounds good. And you're forced to do it for what, like 3 or 4 years now? I don't even know how long we've been doing the show. And so you just get better at it inherently just because you're doing it so often, you know?
Yeah. Now might be a good time to maybe say what sound design is.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So I'm going to ask for two definitions. Could you give me first just like the most general expansive definition of what sound design is?
Yeah. So I think for the general public, everything you might hear in, say, like a fiction podcast or even like in television or movies, it's everything that you hear that's not the music or the dialogue. That includes everything from like the sound of an environment, which often is actually taken out of microphones on films and TV and then added back in. And then stuff like what we call Foley, which is like if you hear a bone breaking, then it's usually like the sound of celery actually laid on top of it.
I love that. Yeah. I used to dream about being a Foley artist.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's probably a pretty good everyday definition.
Dope. And what specifically do you do? Do you do all of that?
I take a little bit of stuff from all the different buckets, I think. Podcast is sort of like its own thing in that there is no visuals. So it's both more expansive and more flexible and sometimes often easier. But also there's no place to really hide if you need to hide. So I don't do a lot of Foley on my own because I'm lazy, one. But two, I don't have like a good sounding studio. I moved to LA recently, so I don't have access to the Multitude Studio as much as I did. So I usually do like things like environments. Those are critical to podcasting because you need to sound like you're in the space. And the vocals are usually recorded in a closet or wherever it is.
Right.
And then like what amounts to Foley, but like using pre-recorded or purchased sound effects to punctuate action within a scene. And then I usually, depending on the show, but most of the time included in sound design is like actually like cleaning up the audio and editing the audio and pacing and all that kind of like regular stuff that goes into every podcast.
Got it. I know a little bit about the process, mostly from you. You have taught me a bit about the process of editing audio and what the steps are. For people who are less familiar, for people who haven't made their own podcasts, what would you say are the steps of creating an audio masterpiece? That's what this is, right? This is a masterpiece.
Oh, it's totally a masterpiece. It's definitely worthy of display in a museum. Yeah, there's a lot more work that goes into it than I think the public at large and even some of the industry believes is either necessary or happens in order to make what I think is like a listenable and decent podcast, even like with chat podcasts, you know, because podcasting has no barriers of entry, really. Besides, you know, financial capital and access to that based on your systematic biases within society. There is a lot of podcasts, especially in the beginning, that didn't do a lot of work put into it because they came from different backgrounds than like the technical space. So like they were tech reporters or whatever it is. But now in podcasting, the threshold for like what audiences will accept as like a listenable podcast have definitely risen, which is nice. So now the audiences expect everything from the first step I do, which is audio restoration, I think you might call it, but like it's basically cleaning up the audio, removing, it's all automated thankfully, but removing background noise, removing mouth clicks, removing plosives, which are when you blow air into the microphone and it sort of sounds like a, I don't know how you would describe it, it sounds like a plosive to me, but it sounds like air being blown into the microphone. Same thing. Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's like the P sounds.
Exactly, like that.
Got it.
So then that step is sort of just makes everything sound cleaner and less annoying to the ears, especially since most people are wearing headphones. And then you go into the actual sort of, some people do it differently. I usually edit next. So that's just editing for content and cleaning up anything that the audio software missed, any pops or smacks or whatever. And then the mixing phase, which is, I think, what a lot of people don't have any experience in. The goal of it in podcasting specifically is to make stuff sound more like itself, really. So like everything from microphones to interfaces to rooms to if you having a weird day colors the sound of your voice. So what I do or try to do in mixing is make it sound more natural, make it sound as if someone's just speaking. And then also limit the volume changes so it doesn't like break your eardrums if someone yells. So that's through tools like equalization, which is when you pick a specific frequency and make it go louder or softer, and things like compression, which is it shaves off the loudest peaks of your voice and makes everything more level. Those are the main two, and then lots of other little like very esoteric small things.
Got it. Yeah, I've struggled a lot with mixing back when I edited all of the episodes of XOLOR myself. And luckily now I'm working with Misha, an amazing editor, so I don't have to do it.
Yeah, ironically, Misha was the sound designer for the Bright Sessions. So they are the person that got me into sound design and podcasting. So it's wonderful to get to work with them now.
Thanks, Misha. But I remember, and I was just getting started, but it could take me like 6 to 8 hours to edit one episode of XOLOR. How long would it take you typically to edit like one episode of Join the Party? Although that's more fiction. Yeah, so Join the Party and then one other more like talking podcast, like Spirits maybe.
Yeah, so I usually quote 4 hours of editing time for 1 hour of raw audio, depending. That's like if I'm doing, you know, my most intense good work and I'm not feeling lazy. But also for like a show like XOLOR where you're not just like cutting from zero to finish, like you're sort of rearranging and looking for the best content and stuff like that. It definitely takes more time. But for something like Meddling Adults, where I'm basically just starting at zero and then editing through and cutting things that are superfluous instead of, but I'm rarely rearranging things. It usually takes like, 4 hours per 1 hour of work. So mentally adults, I think I can finish in a day of work, like an 8 hour work day with like lunch and breaks and stuff like that. But JTP usually takes me, because of the additional stuff in terms of sound design and mixing and all that stuff, it usually takes me 3 or 4 days probably of work.
That ratio is wild. How often do you talk about this with people and they're like, it takes you how long? What?
Well, usually it's when I send a budget to someone and they're like, what the fuck? And I'm, well, you're paying for this amount of time of my work. So, but yeah, I think the biggest thing was when I started working at Marvel, I ended up inheriting something like 4 to 5 podcasts, I think, down the road. And I was the only one on the podcast team. So they were doing the same thing that every white guy in a basement does, which is just like record for 3 hours and then publish it without doing anything to it. And it sounded terrible. It was basically too quiet to hear on the subway. I tried many times on the way to my interview and it was unedited. So like when I got there, I was like, oh no, we're going to make actual podcasts. This is ridiculous. I remember vividly. It's not that big of a deal now because I wasn't that into this person, but I was like dating someone at the time. And I remember vividly this day where it was a Friday and I was there at like 7-ish still editing. And I got a text from this person basically like, hey, I don't think this is going to work because you don't have enough free time.
Oh no.
And then at the same time, my boss came up to me and was like, what the hell are you still doing here? And I was like, you wanted me to make a good podcast. This is what it takes.
Wow. Podcasting is a less majestic mistress than the sea, I feel. Wow. And then you eventually got other people on the team, right? Like you weren't always the only person working on those 5 Marvel shows.
I only ever got one person at my time while I was there named Percy Averillin, who is a wonderful human being and you should hire her for every single thing. So we were a 2-person team for a long time, which was sustainable. Which was doable,
okay.
But we were both maxed out, definitely, and she will attest to that. But she is the most like gung-ho, put your head down and get it done kind of person I've ever met. So yeah, she was a lifesaver when I was there. But yeah. I think when they signed a deal with SiriusXM to like make a bunch of fiction shows and stuff, so they got a whole new team after I left, which is good.
And the shows you were working on, they were like behind the scenes at Marvel type of thing? Like examining or analyzing the movies and shows in the MCU.
Yeah, basically. They were all chat shows. There were 4 or 5 chat shows. And then I worked on more of like a supervisory role on one fiction show. The Wolverine podcast was basically finished when I got there. So I didn't really get a hand on that ball. But for Marvel's, the one that Lauren and Paul and Misha worked on, I worked on that one. So that took a lot of time too.
Cool. What's it like to work with a team with other people in designing? Because I don't know, I do a lot of stuff on my own and then I send it out to Misha to edit and they take care of that side of things. I can't imagine what it would be like to have 2 people working on that. It's the same way I can't imagine how 2 people can co-write a book. Like I just don't understand how that collaboration works.
I have no idea how that works. I mean, I don't know how you are, but I'm definitely like the person who in the group projects was like, no, I'll just do it. You guys can just put your name on. It's fine.
Yeah, same.
So yeah, that's been definitely the biggest learning curve. And I'd be curious to see what Misha would say about this too. But like at Marvel, it was by necessity. Like I just functionally could not take this work all by myself. And so I was lucky enough to find Persia, who was just like other me, but better. and I really had to learn how to like delegate and support someone in the way of saying like, I'm always here for any questions or support you might need, but like, you don't need to ask me questions. You're talented. You got the job because you're good at it. You can just do it. Like, you don't have to ask for my opinion on a thing. Just like your instincts are there, do it. So like really learning how to support people and, not just like force your own vision and like perfect thought onto someone else, but like nurture their inherent way of doing things. That's something that's really difficult and something I had to learn over time. But like for In Strange Woods, which was a show that Atypical put out recently, which is a podcast musical, which is wonderful. You guys should go listen to it. I did the sound design with another by the name of Steven Jensen, who's this wonderful guy who I think, at least when we were working on it, was still in college, working on like a theater sort of tech degree. So that way, because I wasn't really his like supervisor or anything. And the same thing we sort of do for JTP and a lot of multitude stuff. It's like, we just, before we start working, we define what we're going to do, how we're going to do it, and then like, you know, make any suggestions or whatever it is. But for like him and me, I was like, what do you love to do? And he was like, I love doing like Foley and sound effects and stuff like that. I was like, great. I hate that. It takes so long. I love mixing. I love environments. So I'll do those things. You do the other stuff and we'll just split it up. So I would clean up all the audio, edit anything I needed to edit, send off the files to him, and he would do all the like sound effects and stuff, and then I'd get them back and I'd make any tweaks or anything if I needed to on his stuff, or add anything I needed to, but that was very rare. And then I would do environments and mixing and all that stuff and put it all together. So yeah, I think it sort of just depends on your how you're working, but I always say like the number one thing is to like just define what you're going to do ahead of time. Set the boundaries so there's no confusion.
Yeah. And the like zeroth step to this is hire good people that you can trust.
Yeah. I mean, that's, yeah. And I think Multitude will continue to do this down the line. But like anyone we decide to work with, we have a very high standard for, in terms of like, not necessarily just like work quality, but like we want to make sure that like we're not just hiring people because we need someone to do a thing, but because they're going to bring something that we don't have. And they're excited and ambitious and want to do this stuff whether or not we're there, but we want to work together instead of alone.
That's nice.
Yeah, that's why we liked you.
I know. I still think of that as almost like a like my little Cinderella moment with like a podcasting fairy god family coming in and taking me under their wing. So thank you.
No, don't thank us. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Everyone can thank everyone and everyone is welcome. That's how it works. I started listening to Next Stop in preparation for this. I was going to save it for after the defense, but I wanted to be prepared. So one thing I noticed was that if you actually pay attention to what's happening behind the words, there's like a lot of stuff there that I usually don't pay attention to. So since you sound designed this, how much stuff is there behind the words in a typical audio fiction? Like, what's the ratio of words to other noise?
I guess it depends on how you would define it, but if you like look at like pure just like track count, I guess, in your DAW of choice in Pro Tools or whatever, or your program of choice, I think for Next Stop there was probably anywhere from, depending on the episode, anywhere from 4 to 7 or 8. We usually capped it at 8 people per episode just for intelligibility reasons, but and then somewhere in the range of 90 to 100 tracks total. It also depends on how you work. Like, I like to put everything on distinct tracks because it's easier for me.
Okay.
But yeah, somewhere in that range.
So it's 8 vocal tracks and then like 82 non-vocal tracks?
Something along those lines, yeah.
Oh my God.
But I mean, like when you think about like one sound effect, one, like I think there was one part in an episode where someone was like hitting a table or something. And so when you think about that one sound effect, you have to think about the sound of like someone's fist, their flesh hitting something, so like the kind of like splatty noise, and then you have to think about the the table, so like the wood of the table, like a coffee table, and then you have to think about, is this translating? And for me, it wasn't. Like, it didn't sound like what it was supposed to sound like. So I'm like, what else would be on a table and what else would make noise? So I put like a glass on top of the table, so when you hear it, you hear the splat, you hear the thump, and then you hear like the da-da-da-da-da of like a glass moving up and down from the vibrations. So like one sound effect can have up to like if you're talking about like movies, they can have like dozens of sounds underneath it. Podcasts have to move a little bit faster, so I can't spend like, Star Wars has like, you know, one sound designer for 7 scenes in the movie. So they can spend a ton of time on this like one sound effect. But yeah, so it's time it just adds up.
Yeah. How do you decide what makes the cut for being a sound effect? Because, you know, we're making noise in our environments all the time, but you can't possibly include all of that in a show.
Yeah. So for Next Stop and for like Interchange Woods, the first step I always take is talking to, for me, it was me and Eric for Next Stop, but for like Interchange was talking to the people that created it and figuring out what you want the thing to sound like ahead of time. So are you aiming for like super realistic reality? Are you aiming for like a sort of like quasi NPR journalistic style thing? Are you aiming for, I don't know, animated like goofiness, like way over the top stuff? which is things that people don't normally like think about, because when you do it right, you don't notice it. It just is inherent to the thing.
Right.
But for like Next Stop, I did a couple of things. I had everyone record on their own individual microphone like we are doing now. So I had their like raw track, but we did block everything. So like they did move around in the studio according to what they needed to do.
Cool.
Yeah, it was really fun. And I had a binaural microphone, which is like, people call it like 3D audio. It's like, it basically just like is spatial. So you can sort of hear the sound move in the space. But my point of view and Eric's point of view on that, we wanted it to feel like a sitcom. So we wanted it to feel like a screen, sort of. You were watching sort of a screen as opposed to being immersed in it. So there's something called ambisonic, which is like really all around you. But binaural is really just like bi, meaning two, just your two ears. So we filmed it as if it was on a 2D screen.
That's so cool.
And so once I do that, and once I have defined what I want it to sound like and what I'm going for, the aesthetic of it, then I just start like chipping away at things, almost like a, you know, like a rough paint job on your palette or whatever. Just like really just laying stuff down and then going back and listening and seeing like, is this working? Is it effective in what it's doing? Which is the most important thing. Like, is there a reason why it's there? And if not, I usually cut it because I am of the opinion that people listen to words. They don't really listen to sound effects that much. So like if it's not doing something, then it shouldn't be there. And then if it's not working, but it needs to be there, like what can I do to fix it? So yeah, I think when stuff makes the cut, it's because it's performing a function. It is telling the story of the scene or hopefully evoking some emotional response in the person, whether that's like joy or laughter or scariness or whatever it is.
Scariness.
You know the emotion scariness?
I've heard of it. I've seen it on the emotion wheel, yeah. I've said earlier that I mostly just pay attention to the words, so I see where you're coming from. How do you choose the right voice actors? Because the way that someone says the words is almost as important as the words themselves, so you have to find the right people.
Totally. And I'm not, I am absolutely not an expert in casting, but I worked with Julia, who was our casting director, to find the right people for Next Stop. It's simultaneously easier and different in podcasting because you don't have to worry about how someone looks, which in film you do. If you have a character who's supposed to be black, they need to be black. Or if they need to be Captain America and look like every white Aryan boy on the planet, they need to be Chris Evans.
He really is just like the epitome of just like white American Aryan man. Yeah.
100%. So we don't have to worry about that, thankfully, but we still are paying attention to, like, with our casting call, like, any character that didn't need to be defined ethnicity-wise or race-wise, we just didn't include that, or even gender-wise, like, didn't include that. I think we only ended up with Cam needs to be a white guy, because he does a lot of things that stupid white guys do. We tried to get him to be Jewish because Eric is Jewish and Eric sort of wrote him as Jewish. I don't think it's in the text necessarily, but it was hard to find a Jewish actor, so we ended up not being able to find one. But the thing that we looked for that's akin to looks in podcasting is voice. So the most important thing is to try to find someone whose voices either complement or are separate enough from the other people's voices that you can easily distinguish them.
Right.
And part of that is just how you write the character, making sure they have a point of view and a character voice. But the other part of that is like literal tonality and timbre. So we got really lucky to work with our main core group of Nick Von Doulis, who was our first like primary pick. We knew we wanted him to be Cam just because his timing was wonderful. And he was just Cam. I remember listening to his audition tape with Julia and we were just turned it off and we're like, yep, that's our Cam. That's right.
Oh, nice.
And then we got, Ian Henry Walls, who played Samuel Clemens, who just has this wonderful, super unique voice.
Yeah. I've noticed that.
Yeah.
I really love it.
And, we loved his voice so much. And then Yemi Sananga, who played Allie, it's just like this perfect contrast to an energy and tonality and comedic delivery to both of them. Like Nick and Ian are two sides of the same coin kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then Yemi is like another coin that makes it the right amount. I don't know.
I see where you were trying to get in that metaphor. Yeah.
But then the like real magic came. We did a lot of like chemistry testing because we wanted to make sure that the core cast had chemistry, right? That especially in a sitcom, like they carry the whole show. And all three of them are just like, one, wonderful to work with, but two, just like eager and willing to jump in and try whatever it is. They're all incredible improvisers. I don't know the ratio, but like at least 20% of the dialogue in that show is probably improvised.
Whoa.
Yeah, they're incredible. And I ended up directing them, like, let's get one take for that's on the page. Let's get another take if I need to do any changes. And then this third take, like, do whatever the fuck you want. Like, I don't care about the words. Just do whatever you want. And so, yeah, it was just wonderful in that sense. So it depends on the show you're doing, what you're looking for. But like, we were looking for people who could sound different and work together and also like be willing to experiment and improvise and try new things. Mm-hmm. So.
In the casting call, did you like describe types of voices that you were interested in? Like, we want a deep voice, or my partner has spent a lot of time singing and is a rapper, and so he will use terms like, that voice is bright, mm-hmm. or something. And I don't really know what that means, but is that the language, the type of language you used in your call?
Not in the call itself, because I think most people like you don't know what those words really correlate to, which is very normal. And we weren't looking for any specific type for any specific character, just that they, when brought together, were distinct enough. But yeah, like we auditioned a woman, Sam. So she was going to be Samantha. And she was like our second pick for the role. So like it would have done a different combination entirely of voices, but like one that still was distinct enough and interesting in the combination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's about picking the right team made up of strong individuals, but like the team is really important.
Right, yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a little break and then come back and talk more about, you know, Brandon's process for making Next Stop, I guess.
It's us.
Yay. Some people, like yours truly, spend a lot of time on the internet, and some people like making a positive impact on the world. I also like doing that. If you, my friend, are one of the awesome people in the overlapping section of that Venn diagram, then please let me tell you about Tab for a Cause. Tab for a Cause is a browser extension that lets you raise money for charity while doing whatever it is that you do online. Whenever you open a new tab, you'll see a beautiful photo, it's a different one every time, and you'll see a small ad. Part of that ad money goes towards a charity of your choice, and another part of that ad money goes to me. So join Team Exolore by signing up at tabforacause.org/exolore. There's a brief onboarding process, and then you can rest easy knowing that even your most embarrassing Google searches can help make the world a better place. If you like gaming or buying merch, or even if you find yourself sitting in front of a computer screen for many hours out of the week, you can discover a new way to play your favorite games with the awesome gear supplied by our friends over at Inked Gaming. Inked Gaming has been a lead supplier of gaming goods since 2011, and for the past decade, they've delivered some of the best gear imaginable. Inked Gaming introduces us to a whole new world of shopping, gaming, and creating. You'll find everything from playmats to mouse pads to dice bags, day totes, and much, much more. They even give you the creative freedom to express yourself and make your piece of gear totally unique with their custom design options. And for the creative members of the Exolore family, I think that's the part you're going to like the most. Inked is even offering our listeners a special 10% off discount on your order. Just head on over to inkedgaming.com/exolore and use the code EXOLORE at checkout. Again, that's inkedgaming.com/exolore, and you'll get 10% off your entire order with the code EXOLORE at checkout. All right. Now, Brandon, you had a lot of control over Next Stop. what did you spend the most time doing in the sound design process for this show?
Try to remember back. I imagine it just inherently ends up being editing because you just physically have to move through a lot of tape.
Mm.
And I was the director and the sound person, so I knew that I didn't need to take notes during recording because I'm a perfectionist and I need help not doing this. But like I knew I was going to listen through every single take anyway in post. So I know a lot of directors like Lauren will mark takes when they're recording so they can pick that one. And then just work off of that so it's faster. But I went through everything and picked, like, you know, sometimes it was down. I try to take as big of a chunk of a take as possible because it feels natural. But sometimes it's like this word is not sounding right. So I'll have to like pop in a different word from a different take.
Wow.
And so that can take a long time and getting the pacing right and all that kind of stuff. But the sound design stuff, I'd be curious to see what Misha thinks too. But like at this point, I'm so practiced in it that like I know what I want and how to get it quickly, which is nice when you're trying to like paint the broad brush of stuff. And then it's the like little moments where you know you want to like push yourself and challenge yourself to do something interesting or unique there that ends up taking a little bit more time to find the thing that you want. But that's the fun part. So
that is the fun part.
Yeah.
I've heard that some sound designers spend a lot of time like collecting sounds out in the world to put into their projects. Do you do that?
I don't because I'm lazy.
Okay.
I've done it a handful of times here and there, but like there are so many higher quality than I could get sound effects that you can purchase these days that for a podcast in which you're not matching sound to picture, it doesn't have to be perfect in terms of like timing. So like for a film, you have to like match the tearing of a celery stalk to match a bone break in perfect time. But like I can just go and find a bone break sound because it doesn't matter. Like there's no timing. So I prefer to spend my time, well, one, I don't want to spend all my time collecting sounds because I would like to have some downtime, but I prefer to just like pay money to solve that problem to find a bunch of high quality stuff. And you know, Misha does too, but any sound designer really has like a huge sound effects library at this point.
Like, just like on your own computer that you keep and catalog.
Yeah, I have 1.5 terabytes of sound effects right now.
Wow.
For Next Stop though, like there definitely was some stuff that I just couldn't buy. Mm-hmm. So like I had to record like the Slack notification sounds, the Skype notification sounds, a lot of phone stuff. So I went and recorded. I didn't know what I wanted exactly. So I went and recorded like all the major like alert sounds and ringtones and stuff and like the text.
And there's no like copyright issue there?
There might be. But okay. but Apple's not going to come after me for that.
Yeah, they have bigger fish to fry, hopefully. Yeah.
And it's so ubiquitous at this point that I think like I could probably argue otherwise. But on the Foley stuff, like I couldn't find like Eric wrote a scene where Sam has a like lock mechanism for his computer. And so like it's a sci-fi, you know, MacGuffin that doesn't exist in real life. So in the studio, I basically gave him a keyboard and like I bought a big chain, like a big metal chain, so he could get the sound effect in there. And then I went in back and recorded like this chains up close to get it sounding good.
That's so cool.
I used the door on the studio to do a lot of knocking stuff because a lot of it's like esoteric, you know, cute little knocks.
Mm-hmm.
I bought a gong.
And now it's just chilling in your home. You have a gong now?
I think it's in the studio, but yeah. like a hammer, laptop slamming, mic handling noise. I recorded a microwave making popcorn that made the studio smell really good. And like a vacuum, which was hard to find. Yeah, I recorded myself rummaging through the studio refrigerator. That was fun. The big one that's actually hard to find, I think a lot of people would, I know Misha would agree with this, but like kiss sound effects, kissing is really hard to do in audio because don't do this, it's gross. But like if you ever listen to a kiss, it doesn't sound like a kiss, it just sounds gross.
Yeah,
you can imagine it.
I can, yeah.
But getting something that sounds like a kiss, you have to like actually do it how you wouldn't do it in normal life. So usually have to record those separately.
And there are so many different types of kisses too. I'm now imagining that like in scripts you have to specify, is this like a wet sloppy kiss, is this, you know, like a quick cheek kiss?
Yeah, it's gross. But that's actually interesting too, that you bring that up, because what I like to do if I can is, if I'm a sound designer project, before they start recording, once the scripts are finalized, I like to do a sound designer's pass and just go through and either cross out shit that they've marked as sound effects or whatever that are not useful, or add in stuff like, oh, hey, during production, can you do this? Because this is hard to imitate. And like the timing is important there. So like one of the things in the Next Stop we did was one of the characters crumpling a piece of paper and like tossing it. But it's like, it was a comedic moment. Like they were like, you don't have a script for this, do you? And she was like, crumple, 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 toss. No. So, but that's highly dependent on the actor's comedic timing. So I just gave her a piece of paper and had her do it in studio. So that's something I like to do, is go through the scripts and make notes like that too.
I like that. Do you have your own little notation style or like a shorthand that you use? Or is it not that secretive?
It's not that secretive. It's I mean, me and Eric both had to learn like proper script formatting stuff for next time because we've never really done it that way before. Mm. So we just learned the good old fashioned way.
I'm interested in the music that you choose, because like every music piece that I heard in Next Stop like really seemed like it fit, you know, sounded like a sitcom, which was really cool. This was my first comedy fiction podcast experience. So how do you choose music that feels appropriate for the mood in a podcast? And this is kind of a personal request, because I'm thinking of getting new music for Exolore and I don't know how to choose.
We can figure that out. That's okay. One of my favorite things, because I am a musician. I love doing music. I don't know. There are people that are like inherently sensitive, I would say, to like, in a good way, sensitive to music and tonality and what the emotional aspect of it is. Like Eric has a really good ear for that, just because he's a really big music fan. So a lot of times, like in JTP, I'll be like, I can't find a fucking music track for this. Eric, will you help me look? And he'll find something that works. Like the, I don't know if you remember the like Momofuka training video thing, or like the thing that Aggie shows like a videotape of, and it's like a bad infomercial, and there's just like a bleep 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 blop blop behind it, and Eric found that and it was perfect. But for like Next Stop, we knew that we wanted to hit that 90s sitcom feel. We worked with a composer named Evan Cunningham, who is wonderful, who's worked on a lot of Bryce Hessen stuff. He did the theme song for Marvel's too, the Marvel fiction show. And I talked to him on the phone, and I think because I have the vocabulary of a musician, it's much easier. But I do have to, you know, as that, you also have to learn to back off again, like I was talking about earlier, so they can do their own work. But yeah, I was able to tell him, like, I need a variety of things, but for the theme song, we want something sort of like uplifting and friendly and very classic 90s Friends style sitcom trope. But for the stingers that are in between each scenes, I was like, I need a variety of things. I need stuff that reads neutral. I need stuff that reads sad. I need stuff that reads like a get up and go, kind of like heisty, you know?
Ooh, I've learned that, you know, multitude people, we love heists.
We love our fucking heists. So yeah, you kind of like, any musician will sort of know what you're talking about when you say those things. But it's really about trying to find the like emotional core of what that thing reads as. And at its most basic, it's like a major song sounds happy, a minor song sounds sad kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's going off that and then learning to use different scales or different tempos to evoke different moods that way. So like for JTP this season, for my own sanity reasons, I didn't do the music. But before the season, I went and downloaded 100 songs, I think, that I liked that were in very different styles of feeling. So like stuff from like fight music to like accomplishment music to like to like neutral music to sort of like dreamy like explanation music, you know. And then I just employ those whenever they come up.
Do you feel like working on sound design yourself influences the way you experience movies and TV shows and other podcasts where there's sound design?
Definitely podcasts. I do a lot of judging. But I also learn a lot from different people's perspectives, because every sound designer, if you are also a sound designer, you sort of get a vibe for how they work and what they sound like and what their either like holes in their techniques are or where they really shine. Like one I point to is Blackout, which is a fiction show by Q Code. I had Rami Malek in it, which is a 7.5 out of 10. It was a fun listen. So if you haven't listened to that, listen to it. But the sound designer is this guy named Brandon something. I think he worked on, he's a film sound designer.
It's the other Brandon.
Yeah. There can only be one of us. He will be killed at one point. But he works on like Detective Pikachu. Like he's a major film sound designer. But when you listen to it, you sort of can tell that he's a film sound designer. I don't really know how to describe it except for like the feel of it. Like everything feels sort of like glossy and polished. There's a lot of really rich depth and really high highs. But from my point of view, the script was a TV script, not a movie. And TV has a slightly different tonal language than film does, because film is glossy and dramatic, and like TV is more raw and more organic feeling because it's made faster. So like, from my point of view, the sound design was great, but it didn't quite match the script itself. So that kind of stuff like really pokes out in my head when I'm listening to podcasts. But for film and TV, the best thing about it is you do have picture, which like your brain will fill in what it's supposed to be hearing. Mm-hmm. If it's not there, or if it sounds slightly off, like your brain will still be like, yeah, that makes sense. So I don't really notice it a lot, which is good, unless it's really fantastic that it sticks out, like in a good way, or if it's weird. You know, like you're trying, yeah, when you're matching the picture, you try to describe the scene. You're not trying to like make anything weird and spectacular, right? Like a footstep should sound like a footstep, and when it doesn't sound like a footstep, I notice.
Right. Are there any movies that you just really enjoy listening to? Like, I loved listening to the Godzilla movie that came out last year. I liked all the deep roars and grumbles, but what's your preference?
No, that's great. And monster and horror films and like sci-fi are always really fun because they're not sounds that come from nature, so they do have more you have more room to play. Obviously I love Star Wars. It's the original creative sound design movie, you know.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they did.
I've never seen it.
You've never seen Star Wars?
No.
Any Star Wars?
I watched part of the fourth one chronologically, which I think is the first one that was ever made.
Yes.
I watched part of it and walked out.
Oh my God. I will say, I think people who are about our age or younger, like those 70s films don't hold muster very well because they look, yeah, they don't look great and they're kind of clunky.
It just looks so bad.
Yeah. But that does hurt my heart a little bit.
I'm so sorry. But it has good sound design.
Yes. So they did some like wonderfully wild things. Like the lightsaber sound effect itself is like, I think it's, he took a, I'm gonna get this wrong, but I think he took like a wrench to like a big like transformer spring. Ooh. So it was like a big stretched out spring, and then when you hit it, it sounds like boom boom, because the sound is like going from one end to the other end.
Yeah, get that Doppler effect in there.
Exactly. And you mix that in with some other stuff, and like the blaster sounds are wonderful. But more modern stuff, yeah, I actually just watched Kong Skull Island last night. Was it last night? Time is meaningless.
It truly is.
Because I haven't seen that yet. But so yeah, those are really wonderful. I really love the modern Godzilla roar. It's got a lot of interesting animal sound effects in there.
Yeah, I think there was a Spirits episode recently where they talked about a roar. Maybe it was the Beowulf translation episode. Mm. They were talking about the different layers that go into a roar sound. That was, yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah, and that's, the roar specifically can be like a really sonic signature for a sound designer. Like, I mean, you'd be surprised at the weird sounds that animals make when you just see them as a file and you just hit play, you know? Animals make really weird sounds. Yeah, I also love, like, I'm a huge music buff, obviously. So I really love the use of music in film, because especially when you have a picture, the music is the thing that's really conveying the emotion as opposed to the sound design and the acting, obviously. But like something like Dunkirk, I don't know if you've seen that. It's a wonderful film, and I think it's all continuous, like fake continuous, but I think the whole thing is continuous.
Like the whole movie seems like it could be a one-shot type of thing?
It's either that, or I know at least the score is continuous.
Like there's music playing the whole time?
Yeah.
Whoa.
And it's wonderful. It's this beautiful score that just like, if that score wasn't there, it would be a completely different movie, you know? But the score really elevates it and makes it like a piece of art. And things like horror films, like, I never saw this because I don't like horror. I can't stand gore. But the trailer, I remember, for the film Mother with Jennifer Lawrence, I think.
I also can't stand horror.
Yeah.
I'm a little wimp.
Me too. But they use a lot of, like, I think this is kind of becoming more common now in horror, but they used a lot of orchestra sounds, so like violins and violas and cellos, but super dry, meaning like no reverb, no room sounds, just like straight up on the instrument microphone. And then they use, like, they flip the bow over to use the wood side, and they use a lot of like striking techniques.
You can do that?
Yeah. So it sounds like really wooden and terse and strange, like, because you don't normally hear that, right?
Yeah.
And so it sounds really spooky, and it was really effective in what it was trying to convey there. So I like that kind of stuff.
Awesome. I will try to pay more attention to sounds in movies, just the sounds in general. I'm wondering if you have any advice or ways that people could practice and improve their sound design skills without necessarily sitting down and just like making a whole podcast, like little one-off exercises that people could do.
Yeah, I think if you can find a film scene or a TV scene that has the audio stripped out except for the voices, just go in there and like practice designing that way. I guarantee you'd be able to find stuff. But if you can't, just email Multitude and I'll send you some files. And I do think, like, I know you just said without making a whole podcast, but I do think the best thing to do for anything in terms of music tech, whether you're on the music side or the podcast side or film sound design side, is just do it like a lot and fail a lot and figure out why you failed and ask people what they think of your design. Because unfortunately, like for sound design in particular, especially in podcasts, because there is no picture in front of it, like it's really, when something's bad, it's bad. And a lot of people can tell really easily without knowing what they're talking about. So there's no substitute for just practice. So like, as if it were a musical instrument that you would practice every day, just like sit down and do a little bit every day. Read every manual you get for every piece of software you buy, cover to cover. Make sure you know exactly what you're doing. Don't buy another piece of software until you've mastered that one.
That's a good one.
Yeah, a lot of mostly straight white boys in sound will just like me, they like to collect stuff because we're weird. And so they just like buy a bunch of software without really dedicating the time to mastering that piece of software. And then, you know, just listen a lot. There's no substitute for that either. Listen to things that aren't your medium. So if you're a podcast sound designer, listen to music and figure out how they used their EQ or their compression or their delay and reverbs or whatever it is to achieve the effect that they're achieving in you, like emotionally, and then try to replicate that in your sound design. I think those are good places to start.
Yeah, those are great tips. One thing that I have been trying to do, because my partner is working on an album and I just am so bad at hearing the nuances in audio. And so what I'm trying to do now is listen to things multiple times and pay attention to different, I guess they would be tracks each time. So like one listen through, I'll pay attention to the drums, and then the next time to the piano, if there's piano in there. And just like trying to mentally separate that out has been really helpful to get me to focus on hearing the background noise, which I don't mean as, I mean noise
no,
is a
noise
good
is
thing.
Great. If someone called my music noise, I'd be very happy. But yeah, no, I love that. It's a great idea. I always take for granted that because I have a instrument background that like my brain can just separate those things, those layers like really easily. So like if I decide whatever I want to listen to, I can just hear it. But it's always weird to me to hear when people can't do that. Like they just hear like a wall of sound. I don't quite understand it.
We're not all as naturally gifted as you are, Brandon.
No, it just comes with practice. That's my point. Like if you just learn to play an instrument, you would do it too.
I played the clarinet for 8 years and I still can't do this.
Well, then I take it back. But cool. But yeah, that's a great piece of advice. Like, I don't know how you listen to music, but my first pass of music, I don't listen to vocals. Like I don't listen to words. I just hear the melody line on top of the harmony and stuff. But like my partner, Lauren, like she just listens to words her first listen through.
Wow.
So I don't know. Everyone just listens differently.
Yeah. I almost never listen to words, actually. The words just appear as sound to
me too.
Yeah. I can pay attention to the words if I choose to. Like I can memorize, I can sing along, but it's not consciously like being decoded or like understood in my head.
Yeah, same. The only words I know or lyrics I know in songs are because they did some interesting like melodic phrase or like rhythmic thing. So just attach the words to them. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Anything else you want to say about sound design, particularly as it relates to world building?
Yeah, I think as anything, my advice for that is always be intentional and pre-plan. So don't just dive in and start throwing things at the wall. Like know what you want to do and what you're trying to achieve and then plan how you're going to achieve it and then dive in, because that's going to make for a more cohesive project. And yeah, if you're a fledgling sound designer or a established sound designer that wants critical feedback or whatever, like you can always reach out to me, especially through the Multitude website. And if you are from an underrepresented group, you can always ask for some coffee time with Multitude folks. And if you work on sound, I'm happy to talk with you. So hit us up.
Yeah, I can vouch for Multitude as a group of people who are awesome at teaching podcasting noobs how to actually make the thing happen. If people want to learn more about you, not necessarily related to your multitude stuff, how can they find you? How can they keep up with your work?
Yeah, I am a anti-social media stan, so I only have Twitter. But if you want to follow me, I'm at Brandon Grugel, G-R-U-G-L-E is my last name. But yeah, I mostly just post on work stuff. I'm a weirdly kind of private guy. So I will talk your ear off if you want to talk to me in person. But I am strange on the internet.
I get that. The internet's a strange place.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being on the show and for, you know, helping make the show happen.
Hell yeah. Thank you for having me. Let's go find some new music for the show.
Yes, please. Nothing against the old theme song, but I feel like maybe it's time for a little bit of a touch up.
Yeah, I love it.
All right. Well, thanks again, Brandon. And that's a wrap. This episode of ExoLore was edited by Misha Stanton. The cover art is by Stephen J. Reisig. The transcript is by Aizer Moss. And the music is from purpleplanet.com. ExoLore is a member of Multitude Productions, an independent podcast collective and production studio. I highly recommend checking out the other Multitude shows. All you have to do is type Multitude into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. If you want to support me and my world-building work, the first way to do that is to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts. It's free, you don't need any sort of Apple device, and it really does make a difference and help the show grow. Second, you can support me on Patreon. Your monthly support would make it possible for me to continue working on this passion project of mine. So if you're able, please head on over to patreon.com/exolorepod. Again, that's patreon.com/exolorepod, if you can. Be sure to follow ExoLore on Twitter or Instagram at ExoLorePod. And if you like this episode, share it with your friends and subscribe to the show, because that way you can catch me next time on another world.